there is that great Winston Churchill quote from World War II. Okay, there's like 5 million great Winston Churchill quotes from World War II. But this one is the one where he says that we are not at the beginning of the end. We are merely at the end of the beginning. And I think that's kind of appropriate for us here in 2024 in the bike racing season that is the American / Canadian bike racing season. We are now officially at the end of the beginning. We have crossed that threshold where it is going from stage race primarily season to criterium racing season. As you know, we are hugely excited about the criteriums, and you know, the show is called Criterium Nation, but we do love ourselves some stage races because they bring with them kind of a set of nuances that are missing in criteriums, a set of challenges, logistic and otherwise, that crits don't often present. And plus, they're time-based, which has a whole lot of fun in and of itself. It is a topic that we get into here, is that how important are the overalls in the Crit series? How important is the overall for Chicago Grit or Gateway or Tulsa or Toad or any of the other Crit series that you'll do during the course of the year? The accomplishment is insane to go 10 days in a row of doing good enough to put yourself on the top step of the overall for Chicago Grit, or 4 days of winning 4 races, as like Marlies Mejas Garcia did several years ago at Gateway. These are insane accomplishments. And often I feel like we write them off a little too much and don't give them enough wherewithal because we're so super duper focused on who won day one, who won day two, who won day three, that we oftentimes miss the larger picture of one person got third 4 days in a row, or one person constantly finished in the top 10 multiple days in a row and put themselves on the overall podium. I don't know how to appropriately contextualize it. I think it's a mystery, and it's something that we should spend more time debating, discussing, talking about, and at least getting the pictures and posting them on our Instagram and talking about them on the Chronicle. My name is Rob Kelly. This is Criterium Nation, a show about life lived one corner at a time. Oh, and by the way, The Chronicle, that's our newsletter that we've recreated for the second time now, in which folks like Jordan Chaney, myself, Logan Jones Wilkins, we're starting to find contributors who are writing articles. We recently did a preview of Gila and of also Athens and a recap of that race. We did a breakdown on the medal count. We've got stories coming out about Nationals, the road race, and the criterium. We're going to try to use it as a tool that guides us a little bit more in quick responses that are sometimes lacking with this bigger, longer form podcast. So go over to Substack, subscribe, become a member, help support what we're doing, read and learn, so that when you do come to this show and you do listen to the stuff that Alan and I are talking about today, you're coming to it from a level of already knowledge and education that you may not have had before. So The Chronicle over on Substack, you can follow us on Instagram at Criterium Nation. At one point in time, I think we even had a Threads, but I don't really think Threads is real anymore. Whatever. We are also a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows, wideanglepodium.com. You can go there, become a supporter and subscriber, and help financially gift to this effort. We are independent cycling media. We're trying to keep the doors open. We're trying to keep the lights on. All this stuff actually really does cost money. And we're not here to become millionaires. We're not here to become billionaires. But we do want to try to see like Alan get paid and, you know, see somebody like Logan Jones Wilkins be able to afford the ramen that he's eating. So, you know, okay, that's hyperbole, but if you ever wanted to buy us a beer, or if you ever wanted to buy us a whiskey, cup of coffee, whatever it happens to be, and you don't see us at Double Shot or at Necker or any of the other coffee institutions across the country, just go to wideanglepodium.com. There's a place to donate and hit donate and pick this show, Criterium Nation. So Alan and I are breaking it all down here. We're going to talk Voss, Tucson Bicycle Classic, Gila, Redlands, a little bit of Joe Martin, some stuff about Newport News and Tour de Bloom. We're going to talk Athens, Spartanburg, and also Sonny King. That's a lot of stuff. We're recapping the end of the beginning, and we're doing that right now. The first, let's say, third of the season is in the books here. It's the beginning of May, and there's a nice little break right now after the Great American Stage Race of Redlands and Gila and, you know, the initial cadre of races before we get to Nationals mid-month here. So I think, Alan, it's a really good time for us to sit back and have a state of the stage racing community conversation. Is this the state of the country in bike racing conversation? Is that what we want to call it?
Yeah. I mean, I like state of the stage race. I feel like we're here to talk about like the health and wellness of stage racing in the US. Yeah. So that feels appropriate.
So we've got a couple of big, broad issues here that we've divided this up into, and we're just going to go through these. And this has not been prepared like the State of the Union is prepared, where it's meticulously choreographed and applause breaks are in there. But like, we're going to do our best. And I probably won't say folks nearly as much as the president would say folks, but let's give it a shot here. So looking broad picture, Alan, at stage racing, the first six or seven events of the medal account, I think one of the things that we need to talk about is how Jordan Shaney put it, Project Echelon versus everybody else when it comes to the men's racing. Or in another way, Tyler Stites is so damn good that he has fundamentally altered the way that other teams approach the racing.
I don't know if we can say that he's like altering the way that everybody is racing, but certainly, and especially for us, CS Velo, like the first thing we're talking about, or that we did talk about coming into Tucson Bicycle Classic, you know, way back in March, or was that even in February? I feel like I've been on the road so long. But yeah, going into Tucson Bicycle Classic, Redlands, and then Gila this last week, you know, everything is centered around like, okay, how are we going to beat Project Echelon? You know, that's not to say that we're not concerned with like Team California or Evolo or certainly Medellin when it came to Gila, but it's just like Stites has proved and Project Echelon has as a team have proved that they are just the best in the US right now. It's been, you know, exciting and very frustrating, I would say, over the last 2 months, trying to like wrap our minds around that and then execute these plans. But yeah, I mean, it's also great to see that we do have a team that's at such a high level in the US.
I mean, if you look at the way that the medal count is playing out on the men's side, Project Echelon is the top of the men's medal count right now with 18 total medals. Team Medellin is in second place with 7 total medals, and those are all just from Gila. And then you get Team California with 5. So, you know, you're looking at the top three of just sheer dominance by Echelon, especially when it comes to winning the races, to the gold medals. They have so much firepower with Brandon Rim or with Tyler Stites or with, you know, Cade Bickmore or Scott McGill or, you know, anybody basically in their lineup has the capacity to win a race. And when it comes down to other teams, your team included, it seems like you guys are in the category of how can we make it hard on them? How can we make them earn it? And is that kind of the approach that's been played out over those first couple of stage races? Is like, how do we make Project Echelon earn it and spoil it if possible?
Yeah, 100%. That was maybe less so at Redlands, just because those stages and that racing is much more chaotic and unpredictable. And
as you know, I want to say uncontrollable, but Echelon did a great job of controlling that. But yeah, coming into Gila, you know, our team is definitely built around a bunch of guys whose specialty is just like time trialing and then just like big power for a long period of time. So our goal at Gila was, yeah, to be like, what can we do to try and disrupt their train? What can we do to try and like catch them off guard? I guess this is sort of secondary to what we're talking about, but like, we had a lot of bad luck at Gila this year. So a lot of our plans, like if you go and look at the results sheet, didn't quite work out the way we wanted. You know, between, I mean, on stage two, like half of our team got crashed at some point in that stage. And that was one that we were really looking at to like, you know, quote unquote, disrupt Echelon. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure you could ask, again, Team California, Avolo, like any of the other teams that were showing up at Gila looking for a GC result. And they're going to say the same thing, that they're like, you know, their plan might not be solely focused on disrupting Project Echelon, but like at some point in that plan, that's a thing that needs to happen, is that you're not just going to like do your own race and beat Tyler Stites. You need to like get them first and then figure out how to win after that.
Yeah, well, it's hard when you've got not just Tyler Stites, who's exceptional at finishing a race, but Sam Boardman or Ethan Crane or Matt Zimmer or, you know, Laurent Gervais, who are just exceptional at
everything,
not getting beaten.
Yeah.
They're just really good at like, I'm going to go at a consistent pace and I will bring things back. Zach Gregg is like the model of consistency when it comes to just being a diesel. I want to talk about the first stage of Gila, because I feel like there was a real serious game of chicken that was being played on
Mogollon.
Mogollon. Oh, good. Glad I've never spent much time in New Mexico, so I won't be chastised for that bad pronunciation. But the breakaway in that stage built up like 12 minutes worth of a lead or 13 minutes worth of a lead, because everybody in the field was looking at you, CS Velo, or at Project Echelon, like, why aren't you bringing these guys back? Why aren't you bringing these guys back? And then all of a sudden it was just like, okay, the order came in, go. And four of you went and just like dragged those guys back. Is that impression wrong?
No, it was like, it was straight up Cold War politics. Like, yeah, coming into stage one, like obviously we thought we were going to be able to win the race. Echelon knew they would be able to win the race. And, you know, I'd like to think that a lot of teams, like you said, were looking at the two of us. So, I mean, stage one of the Tour of Gila is, it's just like, it's always a power test at the end of the stage, because Mogollon is, it finishes up a 20 minute climb basically. And the first hour of that race is gradual downhill, where we'll just be averaging 30 miles an hour, no problem. So getting in the breakaway on stage one is, it's just like a death march. Like, you're never going to make it. You're going to waste a bunch of energy trying to stay away. So when a group of four guys rolled off the front, like Echelon, us, California, like everybody was just like, perfect, great. That's what we want. Like a small group, it's going to be easy to pull back. But then immediately, like, no one wanted to ride the front. So we're basically just like coasting downhill for an hour while this gap is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then finally, like, Sam rolls up to Taylor and he's like, okay, we'll put somebody on the front if you guys are willing to put somebody on the front. And Taylor was like, oh, I don't know. Like, I could go talk to our team car. And Sam's like, all right, I'll go talk to Stites. And like, they go their separate ways, come back together. And eventually, like, literally when the gap was at 14 minutes, it's like, okay, we have to do something about this. So we both put two guys on the front. And they shared the workload when it came to pulling those guys back. And it was a hard chase. Like, they were on the front, basically Taylor, Will Gleason, Zach Gregg was on the front, and Cade Bickmore were the four that for those full 60 miles were pulling full gas. And like occasionally a Medellin guy would take a single pull. I think California sent somebody up for one or two pulls, but it was basically those four guys pulling on the front for 100K to bring this breakaway of four back before we made the right-hand turn and started the climb. But yeah, it was just like kind of silly for an hour there.
That breakaway was a legit breakaway. I mean, you had somebody from Skyline in there. You had somebody from Canals, somebody from EcoFlow, which is just the Canadian junior squad. And then Rio Grande. It's like, those weren't inexperienced bike racers who were just Weekend Warriors. You know, that was a powerful group that went up the road. But larger picture, do you see CS Velo now as having crossed that threshold to the point where people are like, Owen Wright and Josh Lebo are going to try to win this stage race, so we're going to make them win this stage race? Like, all the other teams are like, nope, CS Velo, if you want this, you've got to come out and throw punches with the big boys.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that's certainly the expectation we have, is that people are going to be looking at us, especially Owen coming off second place at Redlands, and Kieran Haug, he is just like definition of pure climber. So we knew he was going to go really good on Mogollon, really good the last day, was in the white jersey for a long time. You know, yeah, like, we definitely have the guys, and people know our guys and know that they're good. So we wanted people to look at us, you know, in the same light as Echelon, expecting us to go the front, and we came into the week like ready to fill that position.
So Stites now has an agent.
Oh, good.
He had not had an agent in the past. And as we've all learned, Tyler is not one to brag about himself or promote himself or talk very vociferously about his capacity. So having that agent is probably going to be a huge advantage to him. But do you think, after we reach nationals, that this is the last we will see of Tyler Stites in the United States not racing on a world tour team?
God, I hope so. It is, like, obviously tons of respect for Tyler, but Jesus Christ, it is frustrating to like train so much and show up to these stage races and then just like watch him and Cade and Scott McGill and all those dudes, they just make it look so easy, and it's just like wildly frustrating. And even when we're, you know, we're getting close, like Owen was very close at Redlands, like this weekend, we definitely had flashes of like, you know, we are competitive with them. But when they're winning, you know, 3 out of 5 stages and just have a chokehold on the race on the 5th stage, so, you know, nothing quite plays out the way it has in years past or you expect it to, that can be really frustrating as a racer. But yeah, I mean, Tyler has shown time and time again, this year especially, he is at the level where he should be in Europe. Like, he should be doing those races. He's won European races before. Like, he's definitely ready for it. And that is where he belongs. Yeah.
So another takeaway here from this early part of racing is the, you know, if you want to look at the converse almost of how the season has played out on the men's side. On the women's side, it's been extreme levels of parity between, I'd say, probably 4 or 5 major teams. And, you know, you can look at Fount, Seniska, 2024, and DNA Pro Cycling. At least as far as the stage races are concerned, they've shown extreme levels of evenness. And the women's racing has been, as a result, very dynamic. I know that they're typically racing at the same time as you are, so, you know, like, you don't get to see it happen. But, you know, is that what you're noticing as far as the results are concerned, that the Lauren Stevensons, Marlies Mejías Garcias, and Emily Ehrlichs, and Nadia Gantova, you know, like, they're all just incredible bike racers, and it's so even.
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is where the medal count like really comes into handy. That's, I've been following along with that, honestly, more than just like looking at results. That, yeah, whereas like you said, on the men's side, things are just sort of piling up on Echelon's side. On the women, it's spread across like 4 or 5 different teams. Yeah, it's super exciting. And it makes me wish that people had a way of watching these races. So, you know, much like, it's sort of mirroring the women's world tour, I would even say, where a lot of the women's racing has been more exciting than the men's racing. Obviously, the men's in the US has been dominant in a different way than over in Europe. But the point still being that, yeah, their racing seems like it's really exciting. I think it's exciting. I got to imagine for the women's exciting when there's that many different people who are having success that, you know, if you're on a good day, any given day, you could get in a break and like, you're riding that race thinking this could be my day. I'm going to get a stage win and like, you know, be a high point of my career. So yeah, it's really cool to see and fun to follow along with. You know, we finish our stages, everyone's pretty cracked, but looking through, getting to watch the podiums, it's rad.
So one team that I was not aware of probably very understandably, was the Tashkent City cycling team, the Uzbeki team, which I believe is the capital city of the country. And, you know, they had Yanina Kuskova as kind of their big star and takeaway rider. It's really kind of fun to see these non-endemic teams come over and test things out. Cause I mean, like, where in the world would you think a Tashkent-based team would find out about Silver City, New Mexico? Like,
I was just thinking that. Like, yeah, like, who in Silver City knows someone on that team that they were able to convince them to come, like, across, like, what is that, three continents, basically, to come race in Silver City, New Mexico? And I know, yeah, I think she was in the green jersey for a while. I don't know if she ended up winning it, but I think after the second or third day, she was still in the sprint jersey.
And there's 35 million people in Uzbekistan. And the currency is the SOM, the S-O-M. And its dialing code is 998. I mean, these are all wonderful things that you can get really quickly. But it takes 17 hours to get from D.C. to Tashkent.
Oh, man.
And I am confident that's not a direct flight from Dulles at all.
Yeah, definitely it's not. And then, like, and that's D.C. And then you have another, like, 5 hours. Well, yeah, 5 hours to get to, like, Phoenix. And then you got to drive another 5 hours from Phoenix. Like that is a trip for them.
I really kind of wish we could get them on the show and just talk to them about their experiences, because you know, you're looking, they're a UCI continental team. It's not like they're a joke. You know, they're a big team. But, like, what sort of resources do they have versus, like, a DNA Pro Cycling or a Sinisca? You know, teams that have a closer connection to American markets and American brands and things of that nature. I need a second here, because I don't even know what bike they were riding.
Ooh, yeah. I only ever saw them, like, walking around before the stage, so I don't remember the bike. But, I mean, they must be quite well-funded and quite well-supported, because they've been listed as, like, a dark horse for the women's, like, Tour de France Femmes Avec Zwift. That's what it...
I think that's how it goes. Yeah, why not? We'll go with that.
Yeah. Yeah, like, they're a dark horse for the Tour de France. So they're certainly a good team. Certain, like, you, I feel like you don't even get into the Tour unless you're quite well supported. So at minimum, I would say they have some, like, some solid financial backing.
Well, one way, shape, or form or another, they're going to be fun to watch in the future and to see, you know, what we can learn about them.
Now we have a secondary team, well, not secondary, but just a new team to root for while watching the racing. So that's cool.
If I'm looking at the picture that I've got here from Kai Caddy, it's a Laroom is the name of their bike. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's like this pearlized, almost pink color. And, you know, it looks legit. Durace crank arms on it. I'm looking at the non-drive side, so I can't see any of the other stuff, but it's definitely Shimano. So they've got some funding. So, you know, we'll talk more about that. Flipping over very quickly to look at the way that the criterium portion of this, so like the Sunny King and the Spartanburg and Athens races work, that parity is equally on display there, but it's DNA and Legion and the Miami Blazers. And I got a very, shall we say, animated text message the other day from a friend of the podcast, Michael Bodigheimer, saying, "Oh, it looks like the women on the Blazers don't have too much love loss or friendship for the women on Legion, because their elbows are out at Athens." And I love everything about that. I love the fact that you've got women in the Schneider sisters versus Alexis and Kendall who aren't afraid to go elbow to elbow. And just because they were friends and teammates before doesn't mean that they don't want to win races. I mean, like,
I'm sure this probably isn't like public knowledge, but within the Peloton, it's like somewhat well known that they aren't like the biggest fans of each other. Yeah, so especially when it comes into race time and speed week and, you know, big crits like Athens and Spartanburg and all that, that they're going to be battling and not holding back anything.
Definitely Alexis has been coming out ahead a lot of the time and, you know, winning back-to-back Athens. Not something that's easy to do in any way, shape, or form.
No, definitely not.
Even on the men's side a little bit in those races, there's been some extreme levels of parity. You know, when you look at Ribble and, you know, Rainstorm and, you know, Legion, there's a lot of even-headedness between them. And I just got to tell you, I loved the way that Ribble raced Spartanburg, where they had guys leading the breakaway and leading the field at the same time, because Spartanburg's only 800 meters around and you can lap pretty easily in an 800 meter course. And the Ribble guys didn't want to lap up because their strength was in the breakaway, whereas Rainstorm, their strength was in the field. So if Danny Summerhill had gotten back into the group, he would have had all of his men leading him out, whereas Ribble was just like, no. Our two guys are here. We're ready to go.
Well, and the best part of that is that they basically like landed on that strategy because of what happened the night before, where they, again, had two guys in the break with, it wasn't Summerhill, but Alfredo. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, it was the night before they had... Rainstorm had Alfredo and Gomez in the break. They did lap up. And then, you know, well, also Legion had Robin Carpenter in the break. And basically what we saw was Rainstorm, formerly ACG, did what they did all last year, waited for Legion basically to like burn all their guys. Magner did a hell of a job with two laps to go. He made it a lap and a half, but, you know, that half lap short. And then Rainstorm took over and Alfredo just absolutely nuked everybody in the sprint. So after experiencing that, going through that, which I think that aspect of crit racing was new to the Ribble guys, where I think in the UK, what I believe is that when you lap up, they just like pull everybody who got lapped. So if there's six of you left, like, you're the sixth that finished the race. So coming to the US, it was new to them where they lap up and then your team is still there and get to help out. Yeah. So then comes Spartanburg. They had two guys in the break. Their guys went to the front, Redding basically just hard enough that the break didn't lap up. And then, I mean, Spartanburg is always a chaotic race, but the finale of it this year was extra chaotic because there was a huge crash with basically a lap and a half to go back in the field. So when the leaders came up on that, it was just a messy sprint basically. But yeah, I mean, Ribble played it to perfection. And what we saw was that they got the win and it was sick. It was like such a fun race to watch tactics wise.
It was a little confusing there in that last, I would say, two corners of the final lap for the leaders. And so the last two corners of the penultimate lap for everybody else, because there was that crash and you did see riders in basically the way of the sprint, trying to finish their second or one to go lap where everybody else was on the finishing, and it got chaotic. And, you know, some people had mentioned that the officials were saying stop or slow down, you know, sort of thing. And everybody else was in the, like, am I supposed to slow down? Am I supposed to stop? And like, you know, the guys from Ribble didn't slow down. Other people did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were no officials like trying to neutralize them with half a lap to go. So it's kind of like play until the whistle blows. And yeah, kept going. Dude had an amazing sprint.
So speaking of neutralizing, I've never seen a field neutralize itself like they did at Athens.
That was new.
And I've never seen a field go to the podium announcers, the broadcast announcers, and be like, okay, you need to tell us what to do, rather than going to the official and being like, whoa, what's going on here?
Well, and I guess, so to like, for anybody who maybe didn't watch Athens, basically what happened was on corner three, it's a downhill left-hander, a single guy crashed. It, to be fair, it was a, I think it was an NC or a Nashville local guy, kind of a gnarly crash, slid headfirst in the curb, but he did manage to like get himself up and out of the way. But despite this crash, the race was still neutralized.
Well, first off, it's not Nashville local. This was Nick Luther from North Georgia. Yeah, so Nick is a friend and he's somebody I talked to after the fact. And he bounced vertically, or not vertically, horizontally off the curb. Like his head went right into the curb. So he was pretty screwed up, but like he was able to get off the road and to get away. But they did neutralize everything, which allowed the Tom Gibbons, Michael Garrison, and two Ribble riders to be caught by the field. Now,
But they never fully came to a stop, right? And then so the complaint was also Robin Carpenter and Danny Summerhill were like, they hadn't caught the break yet. They were still, I would say, in no man's land. And then it all comes back together. They never actually like fully stop the race. Like the lead moto takes off, like, all right, racing's back on. But then the racers themselves were like, no, like you need to give the gap back to the break. So they rolled around for like four laps. And every time they would come through, like not racing, but like the racing's on, the riders just decide they're not going to race. And every time they come through the start finish, like Robin's yelling at Frankie's yelling back at them. And he's like, why don't you guys just stop then?
This is one of the few times that having the mic and feed of the public announcer was great, because we could like actually hear how the sausage was being made. Cause normally when it's like Brad Soner and company that are in like the trailer or off site a little bit, you lose that direct connection. But with Chad Andrews and Frankie right there, you really got to hear how it was going down. And
yeah. And they weren't even yelling at the officials. Like Robin's literally just yelling at Frankie. Like the officials are secondary to what was going on. Like he was he became like the head official in that moment.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the head official was Mimi Newcastle, who is a UCI, you know,
top, very experienced,
very experienced, very capable, you know, official who did sort everything out rather quickly once it got done. And then they restarted, but they restarted with six people in the breakaway. And, you know, a lot of people have come to me and said, what the hell happened? I don't understand it. How did Robin and Danny Summerhill get into the break? And Robin has commented, you know, and said, like, not everything that happens in the race is caught on the live stream. These things do happen in between the live stream, you know, and for me, it all happened at a point in time when I was getting up to get an ice cream sandwich. So I didn't see it live. Like I had to go back in time and be like, how the heck did Summerhill get to this break? And so, you know, there was a stir that came up, but everybody who was in the breakaway seemed to agree that Danny and Robin belonged there. So no harm, no foul in any way, shape, or form, because all the people who were closest to it said, nope, this is the way it's supposed to be. And so they took off, and, you know, Gibbons was on a mission clearly that night. And Robin Carpenter is an insanely talented bike racer who just has an engine for days. And the two Ribble riders, you know, Brock and Cole Davis, they're phenomenal bike racers. And Michael Garrison, you know, from the great team of Privateer is phenomenal. And Danny Summerhill's one of the best bike riders in the country. They're going to stay away, especially when there's nobody left to pull them back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, once they restarted with Robin and Danny in that break, like I got to imagine everybody knew that was the race right there.
The only teams that missed out were ButcherBox and Blazers, frankly, that had the capacity to affect the race. And that's just not enough bodies.
No. Yeah. Yeah. That is too loaded of a breakaway. Yeah. And then I feel like Robin played the card that he had, you know, again, probably that group didn't really want to lap up and give Summerhill all of his teammates back. So Robin went with like, I want to say it was eight laps to go, and or maybe even more, maybe it was 10, made it to two to go. You know, I was talking to him after, and he was a bit frustrated that the finale played out the way it did. I think, you know, when you reach Robin's level, your competitors have sort of a anybody but that guy mindset, where it's when he's off the front, they're like working together to chase him down because they know he's a threat. But then immediately someone counters, in this case, Thomas Gibbons. And then all of a sudden, everybody's just sat there. But that's also just, you know, kart racing. That's, you know, the difference of 10 to go versus the last lap and a half, basically.
Well, Robin, because of the ferocity of his attack, was able to shed one of the two Ribble riders. So now the break went from 6 down to 5. And I've never successfully pulled Robin Carpenter back ever in anything, like a coffee ride. So, you know, I know he's just phenomenal, but like Gibbons wasn't playing around when he attacked either. I mean,
oh no. Yeah. I mean, you could, like, that is just a textbook, like, last lap and a half attack right there.
And it's really what Gibbons is just genetically, naturally, physically talented enough to do. It's not like he's an exceptional sprinter and he's won a lot of sprints, but I think from his time in Belgium, that 5-minute sort of effort is just like right within his wheelhouse, or probably more like 3-minute effort from that point. So like, it's just,
well, that, and yeah, he spent, like, you know, all winter training with the, like, Team Pursuit, the track Team Pursuit team, which is a 4-minute full gas effort. So yeah, between just the crazy amount of mileage the dude has been doing, and then a winter of, you know, training exactly for that 4-minute effort, like, he was gone. He wasn't going to be pulled back.
So phenomenal result for him, for all the guys on Automatic. I know that they have been dreaming about this particular win for a while, and they very much earned it. Now that we've had our little interlude here talking about Criterium Racing, we need to get back to the state of stage racing and to talk specifically about the up-and-coming stage races, not up-and-coming stage racers, but the up-and-coming stage races that seem, fingers crossed, poised to fill the void, both geographic and calendar-wise. So, you know, Joe Martin regrettably postponed for 2024. You know, I'm hopeful that it comes back in 2025, you know, but we know postpone in bike racing seems to sometimes mean dead. But let's hope that this comes back. But like, one race that has really grown up very, very quickly is Tour de Blume in your old neck of the woods in the state of Washington. What is that race all about?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wanted to include this really to highlight like Blume specifically, but also some of the more regional, you know, shorter, but regional stage races that are just really, really good. And the first one that comes to mind for me is Tour de Blume. It's in Wenatchee, Washington, which is small town, basically nestled in the like smaller mountains within central Washington. And yeah, I mean, the stages out there are amazing. Basically the scenery in Wenatchee, if you haven't seen it, Google it, look at some pictures. It's incredible. But the race director there, Ace, I can't remember your last name, but yeah, Ace has been hustling, man. Like, he's been working really, really hard to bring Tour de Blume to a national level. Previously, the few times I did it, it was a 3-day, 4-stage race. And for 2024, in his effort to try and bring it up to a national level race, sort of on par with Joe Martin and really Redlands, he added a 4th day and a 5th stage. So it's happening right now. The stages look super fun. They're really hard. They're like proper road stages. The first stage was, I think, 68 miles with 7,000 feet of climbing. It looked gnarly. It looked hard.
So Wenatchee is Wenatchee. And there's a visitwenatchee.org, which has all sorts of outdoor recreation, you know, wonderful stuff. And it looks like this is like the heart of apple country. Like, is this? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Correct. Okay. So this is a wonderful place to go and visit. And, You know, there seems to be like a really outdoorsy scene, but you know, the Pacific Northwest, as far as we are concerned, the Pacific Northwest is kind of like this void zone for really like phenomenal bike racing that we've talked about. As far west as we go is typically Boise, you know, so this is that area. I think that there is a great opportunity for stage races in these geographically typically underserved areas. You know, am I biased because I'm always talking about East Coast and Midwest stuff? Like,
it might just be a recency bias where, I mean, the Cascade Cycling Classic, which takes place in Bend, Oregon, or I should say took place, was, I mean, at one point it was a UCI stage race. Its last year was in 2019 and it was an awesome race. But again, another race that fell victim to COVID in 2020. That being said, they are hosting a crit this year, which I am hoping means that they are trying to bring back the stage race as a whole. So if you're looking for something to do, middle of August, Cascade Cycling Classic Criterium will be happening in Bend, Oregon. And then another Oregon stage race we have, another 3-day, 4-stager, is called the Baker City Cycling Classic in Baker City, Oregon. This is just 2 hours west of Boise. It's another stage race that at one point, the first year I did it as a 1-2, like Project 303 was there. A Volo has shown up for this race, and back in like when Gage was on the team and Eric Bruner and Scott McGill, and they just like wrecked havoc. So I think the Northwest actually does have a lot of stage racing that is really, really good. It just, I think a lot of people don't know about it, and they can be in sort of inconvenient places to get to, but I think the more that people sort of come and experience these races, they'll be like really impressed, and we can see these races turn into something bigger.
We've been following Valley of the Sun, Tucson Bicycle Classic, Redlands, Gila, and Joe Martin pretty religiously for the last couple of years. But then once we get to this point in time in the year, it's like crit, 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 because that's what the calendar shows. Killington is back for 2024. I know it's back. I don't know if it ever left, but it just kind of like fell off my radar the same way with Green Mountain. Now, Green Mountain is an incredible race, an incredible event. Your team has won it in the past, the GC, and it's got one of the best criteriums as far as a stage race is concerned in the downtown Burlington one. I remember not Cascade, but Catskill was always a great race, but I think that's gone now. There was one that I was just looking up, which was the Mississippi Grand Prix, which was a personal favorite of mine because it was like down the street from where I lived when I lived in Mississippi, but it was 4 stages over 3 days, including a 3-mile, not prologue, but a 3-mile time trial that was tossed in the middle of like you had a 90-mile road race. And then that afternoon, 3-mile time trial that typically separated everything. But like, you know, that 3-day or 2-day, 3-stage stage race opportunity, I think is incredible. Like that's a go-to for elite level, maybe not, you know, CS Velo domestic elite team level, but at least elite level regional. And then you build a 4th day or something like that. And now you're really off to the races. I'd love to see more of these come back. We definitely have the brass rings, you know, of the Redlands and Gila and, you know, Tucson Bicycle Classic. But like, you know, I think folks, I promised that I wouldn't. Yeah. But I think I would love to poll the audience and to get people to write in and talk about their, you know, very favorite local or regional stage race or Omnium. Like, I think that's a phenomenal way of getting promotion there.
Yeah, I would love to just do an episode where we go west to east, east to west, and talk about all of the regional stage races you can do. One thing that this last week, like Will Gleason and I and our team were talking about, was kind of USA Cycling as basically one giant like development league, right? You know, we could view ourselves as professionals, and certainly Echelon is. And we take these races very, very seriously, but I think we can all agree that at the end of the day, the goal is to like take as many like young American cyclists as we can and like get them to a point where we can ship them off to Europe and like see success, which has been happening a lot lately. But you only get them to that point if you have, you know, regional racing that's readily available to like develop them out of like, you know, quote unquote early age. And then sort of from there, upgrade to the Redlands, the Joe Martin, Gila, stuff like that. And like, that's where they really cut their teeth and like make a name for themselves. Yeah. So I think, you know, for the sake of the health of American stage racing, it would be cool to go through and like really highlight some of these races. And maybe, I don't know, I don't want to overstep the bounds of like the, I guess, what do you call it? The breadth of this podcast, but maybe, yeah, shine some light on some stage races that maybe otherwise wouldn't get it.
Because I mean, like Riley Sheehan on the podium yet again.
That Wednesday semi-classic one dayer. Mm-hmm.
At one point world tour, you know, third place at the Eschborn Frankfurt. You know, that rolls off the tongue very easily. But like he is, as far as I can see, he is the perfect example of somebody who cut their teeth here in the United States, racing criteriums, racing stage races, you know, even being a part of the NCL. And now he goes over and, you know, wins Perry Tours, and he's found a spot on a UCI World Tour team. And it's like, this is exactly why we set this whole system up, is to do that.
Just because I know people are going to comment on it, Israel Premier Tech, not quite a world tour team, but they, you know, they get invited to all the world tour races, and the race he was third at was a world tour level race. Sorry.
Yeah. I've gotten caught by the Israel Premier Tech Izmir. Yeah. Like I've gotten caught by that trap a couple of times, and like
next cycle, they're going to be a world tour team. So.
Yeah. But so here's the question that I've got. Like you have these legit stage races like the Gilas and the Redlands that are time-based, right? Then you've got the classic Omnium, you know, like the tour of Newport News or something like that, or most of your local stage races, because, you know, a timing system's expensive and doing it that way is hard. But what about the Speed Week in Chicago Grit, Tour of America's Dairyland? Like we get so excited about who wins each individual race, but sometimes we lose the thread on who's winning the overall. And people are very serious about the overall in those competitions too. Like I remember when I think it was Alec Cowan was in yellow at Intelligentsia, which is now Chicago Grit. Like he blew out literally every single spoke on his bike's front wheel at the Winfield stage or the Winfield crit on the last lap. But he's just like, I need to finish this because I'm in yellow. And so he like rode the last half a lap downhill with a wheel, like with three spokes on it, you know, just because he was trying to win or stay in that position. Are these stage race or criterium series, excuse me, as big of a deal as Redlands or as big of a deal as the individual race within the crit series?
I mean, I having never done any of these crit series, at least not start to finish, I can't say for sure, but I would imagine that if you are a team like ButcherBox that is, you know, a crit team and focus on doing those races, like, yeah, that is as big of a deal as Stites winning Redlands is for Echelon. Like you said, like most people, if they blow out their entire front wheel, maybe they go to the pit, get a new wheel, get back in. Most probably they just call it a race right there because that is like a catastrophic event. But yeah, I mean, along, you know, there's definitely prestige that comes with being able to win a series as long as like Tour of America's Dairylands. What is it? 11 days, 11 races. And also the prize money that comes with that. Like that is something that no team is going to, you know, bat an eye at or turn down.
But we've seen so many teams kind of airdrop in to these race series for the ACC weekend race. or for the big one, whatever the big one happens to be, you know, 10 days of Chicago Grit is logistically challenging and expensive. 11 days of Toad is expensive unless you're staying at Eric Hill's house. And, you know, I've tried to do that numerous times, but there's always trouble kicking his kids out of their bunk beds in order for me to stay there, right? Send them camping,
stay Eric. At the grandparents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, 4 days of Gateway is eminently manageable for any team, you know, and Marlys Mayos-Garcia, you know, basically swept it 1 year, like all four races. Was that the ultimate accomplishment for her season? I don't know. But, you know, like for most teams, like having that to brag about is a huge deal. I mean, having Owen get second at Redlands, how far do you think that CS Velo is going to push that result? Like when they start talking with Ventum or with Jack Rue or with any of your other sponsors, like, look it, we got a dude standing right next to one of the best bike racers in the United States. You know, I just think that all these things should be equally potentially celebrated.
Yeah, 100%. And like, that's the beauty of Omnium is that you don't even necessarily need to do them all. If you're good enough, you can drop in for half the races. And like Marcia is, she could probably drop in for half the races, most likely gonna win them all. And then still, you know, that'll be enough to win the Omnium. But yeah, I mean, she's definitely putting that on her CV. You know, if she ever decides she's ready to move on from 2024, she's putting that on her CV as, you know, Tour of America's Dairylands Omnium winner. 2024, like you said, is for sure using that as like, this is a reason you should sponsor us. She's on the podium like every single day. She's on the top step of the podium. Get your name out there. And so, yeah, I mean, with all racing, it's definitely something that's going to be used and is very useful and appreciated.
So let's talk about the kind of the final topic that we had prepared to talk about a little bit, which is the dedication of the people who are engaged in this endeavor. I think it was Will Cooper who lost most of the skin on his front arm from the crash on the second stage. You've got somebody like Emily Ehrlich who's broken her collarbone and had it fixed. You've got a person like you who left your house in Boise like last year and won't be home until the middle of June. You know, people are taking time off of their real jobs to spend here in Silver City, New Mexico, or, you know, to be driving up and down the coast, all for the lucrative honor of, I don't know what, like I got on a podium the other day and my podium prize was a muffin. It was a damn good muffin, but like,
yeah, you know, best muffin in your life. Yeah,
best muffin ever. But like, you guys are some real road warriors.
Yeah, I think, you know, in more ways than one, the why of it all is something that I certainly like battle with a lot. And I got to imagine that a lot of the racers at our level do, you know, like what really motivates you to like be on the road for a month at a time. Yeah, like I left my house, I'll be on the road for a month, I'll be home for literally 7 days, and then I'm leaving for another like month and a half. But I think, you know, more so than that, really just like the time dedication that it's taking, I guess, like the time dedication that everybody is putting in despite the fact that we're effectively all amateurs, but then the resulting like rise in like level of racing in the US is really impressive. Basically, we've been using Strava as like our benchmark. And last year for 2023, stage five, the Sunset Circuit race, we set a KOM for the 12 lap circuit. And obviously, I'm sure everybody knows Sunset, extremely brutal. So even though, you know, 10 years ago, there's, you know, 10 professional UCI teams in the country, all these guys are getting paid. They are professional bike racers. Now us, a group of amateurs, are going faster than they did. So I think, I don't know if this is separate from the conversation of should we not get paid, but it's just like really worth pointing out to everybody who's kind of watching along that the speeds we're racing at and like how fast we're going is just like, it's at a higher level than it's really ever been in the country before. And that's because people are putting so much dedication and focus to it.
Oh, the technology is also getting a hell of a lot better. I mean, these bikes are phenomenal.
The ability to late brake into corners with disc brakes is equally terrifying and really fun.
I noticed that I may, compared to the people who I'm racing with, trust my brakes a little bit more than everybody else. You know, we're going downhill into a right-hand corner into a gravel road section the other day, and like everybody's braking, and I'm sitting there looking around at him going like, we got 2 or 3 seconds before I have to start braking. I don't know what your problem is, guys. Like, what are you so scared? But the bikes are phenomenal. The athletes are primed, and the level of professionalism when it comes to the support, I don't think can be overlooked either. You know, you had Christian who was with you, your DS, and Echelon had somebody like Isaiah and a mechanic, you know, who was there, and a lot of other teams had a lot of support. And it's not a sport that you can do by yourself anymore. It's definitely become a very service intensive sport in order to get it done, which means it's not just the racers who are dedicated, it's the Kurt and Meredith who are dedicated, and the Christians who are dedicated, and all these people in all this ecosystem that are like, I want to excel, I want to get better. And, you know, I got to meet the director from Gila at the Project Echelon Gala in Tucson, and like, I love everything about that man. Like, he presents like you would expect New Mexico to present. Like, he lives and breathes it.
And, this topic specifically coming for me is probably coming from a place of, like, having to listen to people say that, like, road cycling in the U.S. is dying, gravel is everything. And, like, I mean, A, I love gravel racing. Like, it is super fun. And that is, you know, objectively where the industry is putting all of its money. But, like, road cycling is far from dead in the U.S. My whole point is that, like, there are a lot of guys right now that want to make a career in road cycling and want to see stage racing, road cycling, you know, Crit Omniums, like, not just continue to exist, but grow and expand. And along with that, like you were talking about, comes the team staff. Like, there are also a lot of teams, ours being one. Project Echelon obviously is leading the charge. Team California, like, after the Tucson Bicycle Classic, or maybe it was before, I was riding up Lemon, and they were doing like threshold where they were doing blood lactate testing, you know, 5-minute efforts, get to the top, pinch your finger, take blood to see what the lactate, like, those are very high level, you know, training techniques that they're doing. And that is just showing that, like, the dedication those athletes have, that the team staff has in, you know, kind of not accepting the status quo of where road cycling is at. So the desire is definitely to see, you know, Project Echelon not being the only UCI professional team anymore. I mean, there's also,
Skyline.
Skyline, thank you. Which, yeah, like, you know, they came for Redlands and they came for Gila, and then they go back off to Europe, which is awesome. So, yeah, I just hope that people see, like, the dedication that's being put in and the desire that it is to grow and, you know, want to be a part of it, I suppose, and also want to see things grow and even be a part of it, try and help with the growth of the sport. And honestly, a bit of a regeneration or a renewal of the sport, I suppose.
This was not something that I had planned or that we had talked about in advance. So I'm catching you specifically off guard, because this episode is going to be released on, you know, the 8th of May, which is going to be just in time for us to start hyping up nationals. So I want to get your prediction of the podium for the men's and women's road race and crit for that. So not all top three, but just who do you think is going to win the men's crit? Who do you think wins the men's road race? The women?
I mean, the biggest challenge with this on the men's side, it's like, well, we haven't seen start lists, obviously. We're too far out. The Giro will be happening at the same time as nationals. So not knowing which, like, pro tour guys are going to come back, I'm going to start with the men's road race because Tyler Stites is winning that shit. Like, he's going to win it.
He's been on the podium the last 2 years and second and third.
I don't give a shit if McNulty's going to be there. He beat McNulty last year. He's going to beat McNulty again this year.
Who do you think wins the women's road race? Assuming that she's there, sort of thing.
Yeah, so for the women's road race, like Corin Lebecki obviously like has won a million U.S. championships, but she was at Speed Week and didn't look particularly impressive, although road race very different. Shania Pallas obviously is like real good. Veronica Ewers is a breakaway specialist. And I think, I don't know how many people have looked at the road course for this year. It's similar to Knoxville. It's basically punctuated by a climb and then like a steep climb and a very technical descent, basically down through a neighborhood. So I think this is a course that potentially could like suit a breakaway artist like her. Kirsten Faulkner is going to be there. Also, like she has been riding super duper strong and like has had some like pretty good success in the spring classics. So I just want to say just Velta for that matter. So assuming that Kirsten Faulkner doesn't fall down, which is another thing that she's kind of known for, I think, yeah, I would have to give her the vote for the road race.
I see at the very bottom of the list one Lily Williams from Human Powered Health. And Lily just finished, I think, fifth this week at a European race. And she's had some incredible results and some big, big European races. So my vote's with her in the women's race. The men's road race, since you talked already about Tyler, I can't pick Tyler. So Lord knows who's next. You know, looking at the list of folks who are registered, as opposed to the folks who are on a start list. I mean, it's all the good guys that you would think should or could be, you know, in contention here. I'd really like to see somebody like Colby Simmons win, just because he did such an amazing job last year and was kind of like a real big spark plug for the course. But you know, I think I'm just going to go out on a little bit of a limb here and say Tyler Williams. He got so darn close last year that this might be a good year for him. So I'm going to go with Tyler Williams from the Miami Blazers, which would be a very interesting outcome.
Yeah, he's got all that like NCL rage that he can tap into now.
Yes. Take us through the women's criterium, the elite criterium, which looks like it's got 43 entrants at the moment.
Well, I guess because it's on the spot, I haven't looked at the crit course nearly as closely as I've looked at the road course. And that I feel is really going to be the decider. Like I said, Alexis Magner looked very good at Athens. Corin Lebecki being the returning champ, can never count her out. Kendall Ryan, obviously super talented, very fast. Also probably wants a little bit of a redemption from last year. Get the jersey back. Let's see. Okay, so the course is six corner, L-shaped, super flat. The amount that it's flat makes me think that this is going to basically come down to like a Sam Schneider, Kendall Ryan battle. Oh boy, I don't like to do it, but I feel like this is a good course for Kendall Ryan.
It's okay. I'm going with Skylar Schneider because I think that she's got the fire. She's ready for it. She's going to be in a good position. And, you know, this will be her first opportunity in several years to be by herself, sort of thing. She's not going to be in a position where she's going to have to worry about anybody, you know, like a Kendall or an Alexis also getting an opportunity. Because I think last year, Skylar was the one who kind of opened it up in the sprint when Corinne came around, and she was the one who responded. So it'll be interesting. So I'm going to go first here on the men's side for the criterium. And, you know, we're looking at really good riders. We're looking at a lot of really good riders and a lot of them. I mean, Stites is registered for it. Don't know if he'll actually get into that, but like, I think that nobody in the United States right now is quite as good as Danny Summerhill is. And so I'm going in with the man from Centennial, Colorado, you know, Danny Summerhill from Rainstorm. I think it's just his year. He's shown that he's nearly unbeatable when he wants to be.
When he wants to be. Yeah, that's real. I mean, Danny Summerhill's 2023 was truly incredible. And I would genuinely love to see him win the race. However, having just watched Cade Bickmore, like, who is, I would say, a sprinter, like, ride the front of a mountain stage race and, like, literally be shedding guys up climbs. And then also still have just like a lethal sprint at the end of the crit specifically. I honestly think that this is Cade Bickmore's year. And Echelon has their lead out like pretty well dialed. And, you know, the Legion doesn't get to do the William Racing Devo composite team like they did at Redlands. So I think Cade Bickmore's taking the jersey home this year.
You know who we didn't mention because he's a recent transfer over is Steven Bissett.
Yeah, he's just not like a crit specialist though.
Okay.
I mean, for the road race, he's going to be a factor for sure. But I think they're going to use him to be riding the front like late into the crit for Cade.
Well, this is going to be a whole hell of a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. So, Alan, thank you so much for, again, helping us break down what's been going on in the world of bike racing in the last couple of months.
Yeah, this was great. We hit a lot of talking points.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the show. We are a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows. Wideanglepodium.com for the full bevy of shows available on the network. Today's episode was written, produced, and edited by me, inspired by Logan Jones Wilkins, and of course, written by the one and only Alan Schroeder. You can find out more about us at CriteriumNation.com, or you can always send us an email at CriteriumNation@gmail.com, where all your emails are, God, how does Tim say it? Gratefully received. We will be back in 2 weeks' time for more stories from our Criterium Nation.